This idea of essentially just sort of thinking culture, it'll just happen, and putting it off and sort of assuming like, well, I'm a good person and I work hard and I'll attract other good people who work hard and then we'll have a culture of hard working good people, you
Yeah,
know,
totally.
and thinking that it'll just sort of fall into place organically. And, you know, I think that's a mistake, honestly, that I sort of made and that Amanda and I sort of made.
And welcome to Wind Down, Build Up, the podcast giving you the tea and the tools to succeed in business. I'm Tabitha Solomon.
And I'm KJ Miller. Today on the show, we're talking about the seven culture mistakes startups make, and we're going to try and help you avoid them.
I'm so excited to get into this conversation. I think people really underestimate the importance of culture and being intentional about building a culture from day one. A lot of times people think it's cheesy or not really needed until the culture is a hot mess, and trying to fix it is really a nightmare.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think it is easy when you start a company to put culture on a back burner because there's so many things you're thinking about that feel so immediate, and culture can feel like this kind of nebulous big thing, you know, to think about later. But, you know, it's like they say, you're going to create a culture whether you think about it or not.
That's
And
right.
so you definitely want to be intentional about it. So I think this is going to be a great topic.
Absolutely. Now, before we jump in, we would encourage you to please pause for just 1 second and follow us if you're listening on Spotify, and leave us a 5-star review if you're listening to us on podcast. Thank you so much for your support. Now, before we get into today's conversation, I thought that we could spend a little bit of tea time sharing personal stories about either cultural, like companies we've worked for, the cultures we work for now, or companies we work our companies now, like things that are amazing about the culture, or maybe something spicy and something about culture that maybe wasn't exactly idea deal. Do you want to kick off, KJ?
I'm still thinking of mine. Let's start with you.
Well, you know what? I'm actually going to shout out my previous employer, Google. So, you know what's interesting is when people think about culture, they're thinking a lot about the perks. You know, you get a shuttle to take you from, you know, your neighborhood down to the office, or the free food, or even that big slide. Yes, that slide exists at the headquarters. I've gone down it. But that's not what made the culture exciting and fun. To be honest with you, like those ping pong tables, like almost never get used because you're working so hard. One of the things that I thought was really like differentiating about Google's culture is this idea of TGIF. Thank goodness it's Friday, but they had it on Thursdays. Long story. It originated on Fridays and people were like, I want my afternoon back, so they moved it to Thursdays. And for about 2 hours every single Thursday afternoon, from about four, I think it was 3 to 5 or 5 to 6, I can't really remember, they would give you like a happy hour where there were like beer and wine and appetizers and stuff like that. But the CEO and the co-founders, Larry and Sergey, they would literally spend an hour on stage telling everyone what's up. What are some challenges we're facing? What lawsuits are we dealing with? What are some new products that are coming out soon? What are some new teams that are happening? What are some problems we're trying to face? He would introduce a new class of interns. Even when the intern class was 1 year, I think it was like 600 people, he still introduced, like, you know, they put names on the screen, but they had everyone there with their caps to stand up and welcome them into the company. But the level of transparency, bar none, was anything, nothing like anything I've ever seen in my life, before or after. And you know, that level of transparency from the top down really permeated the team cultures. What we found is, like in our team, when we had team meetings, people weren't really working in secret or in silos. But people just share what they were working on, what was coming down the pipeline, what were the challenges. Everything that you saw Larry and Sergey doing up top every Thursday, investing that time to give us just the lowdown, really did set the tone. So that is what it means about being intentional about the culture. If you believe transparency is really important to your company and the mission that you're trying to accomplish, it has to start from the top, right? And it has to be modeled at the top. And so then it's just natural for the people on the bottom to do the same. I've also worked in companies where like the top never talked to us at all. Like, I don't know if I knew who the CEO was. I'm not completely sure what their vision was. I don't know what challenges they're dealing with, what's keeping them up at night. And guess what? That was reflected in the team, you know, very competitive people keeping cards close to their chest, but they're being breakdown in communication. So I just want to share that story because I think a lot of people don't realize like the special part of Google's culture that is part of their winning formula.
Yeah, I agree. I think the transparency is, I think it's important. And I think, you know, Google has gotten both a lot of praise and a lot of flack for some pieces of their culture, particularly recently. Mm-hmm. But I think that is one piece, the transparency that people have always tended to praise because it's so uncommon for a corporation of that size. So yeah, I think that's a really great example. I was also going to give a positive example, but you know what? I'm gonna give a negative one just to just to keep it spicy. So, you know, I started my career in retail at Sears Holdings Company. And so Sears, at the time it had merged with Kmart. So it was both Sears and Kmart. And I was a buyer for both at one point. But I came in 2008, and that was right after the corporation had been, kind of taken over by a finance guy. Mm-hmm. Now I'm blanking on his name. He was a really well-known finance guy. He had bought up a lot of the shares and also essentially installed himself as CEO upon buying a lot of the shares and orchestrating this merger. Oh, wow. So, again, I'm blanking on his name. You can Google it. But this guy, and I, you know, I don't like to badmouth people, but it happened long enough ago. And I think enough has been written publicly about Sears that I'm not about to say anything that many, many people before me haven't said. Mm-hmm. But I remember, you know, I'm coming out of college, right? So I'm new. I'm 22 years old. I don't know anything about working for a big corporation. But almost instantly, it became clear to me that a lot of people in the organization, they feared this guy because clearly he's the CEO, but they didn't really respect him. Mm-hmm. And they definitely didn't think that he knew anything about retail because like his background was finance, you know? Mm-hmm. So he's coming in, he's making all of these humongous wholesale changes, but doesn't know anything about retail. And kind of the word on the street, at least from the buyers that I spoke with, was that he wasn't really trying to learn how the corporation worked, how retail fundamentals work. Like he just was sort of like coming in like a bull in a china shop, just making all these changes. Like I remember one change he made was he moved the entire, I think it was apparel department to California, and Sears is in Chicago. So he made this decision to move the entire apparel department to California because he had hired this, you know, new hotshot guy to run apparel. And this guy lived in California and basically negotiated that the whole department would come to him as opposed to him coming to Chicago.
What?
And yes. And so we're talking about like dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of people who basically were told like, you can keep your job if you're willing to move, but if not, you gotta go. And these are people who have, you know, families, like they can't just up and move their whole lives. So a lot of people ended up out of a job, but like the decision didn't, like it fundamentally didn't make sense. It didn't save the Sears apparel business. One guy can't save a whole business, but it was again, the CEO making just like a rash move. He's trying to like be bold, run 100 miles per hour, but not actually dig into, well, what's the real problem with our apparel department? Is it that we need some hotshot guy, or have we been ignoring the fundamentals of merchandising and ignoring the fundamentals of our consumers, our consumer, you know, profile? Like, you know, so it just, I just remember by the time I left Sears, so much, and I was there for 2 years, so much of that culture felt so toxic because everyone was scared, right? Everyone's scared to lose their jobs, scared that these huge wholesale changes are going to happen to them with no real explanation. And, you know, like not knowing where, you know, things are going to be coming out of left field. So everyone is working their teams to the ground, trying to prove that like their team is the team that deserves to stay there. It just was such a negative and toxic environment, at least to me. I can't speak for everyone. Yeah. I'm sure some people were fine. But to me, by the time I left, I was like, I got to get out of here. Yeah. This isn't, you know, it isn't sustainable. And it, and like you said, same with Google, culture starts at the top.
Yep.
So if you come in and you're making these huge changes, but you don't know anything about the fundamentals of the business, people are going to feel that. That's going to feel scary. And that's going to feel toxic.
That's absolutely right. Gosh, you know, when I hear like stories like that, I think to myself, the balls and the audacity to change like something so drastic without being consumer first, you know, and doing it for like one individual and not thinking about like the whole, like the implications for the workforce. What will lead someone to make that? I mean, I'm like, I must be missing something, because on the outside looking in, it, I hate to say this, it feels so idiotic, you know?
Yeah, it didn't feel like it made sense to anyone there either, you know, okay. But like this guy clearly felt like, oh, I've got a plan. I know what I'm doing. I'm the smartest man in the room. This is going to be what takes us to the next level. Yeah. And of course, none of that happened.
Right.
Like there was no rebound in the business, you know, but it just, yeah, it frankly was a mess.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great transition to really define like what is company culture and how is it formed? Because my reaction when I think about company culture, I'm thinking about the attributes, the behavior of all the employees, things that are intentional or unintentional, conscious or unconscious way of just how you get things done in the workplace. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that how you define company culture, or is it slightly different?
Yeah, I think that's about right. I think culture is, you know, the set of, it's like your ways of working and your ways of being at work.
Yeah.
Is how I think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if you're thinking about how you get work done at the workplace, obviously that's critical, right? And what we're going to talk about now is some cultural mistakes we've seen startups make, whether we've made it ourselves or, you know, like I was based in Silicon Valley for like half a decade. So seeing all that up close and personal, what are some mistakes that we're commonly seeing? And I'll go ahead and kick off the conversation. One thing I'll say that I saw pretty often in Silicon Valley is this idea of hiring your friends only. You know, it's one of those things where you're like, well, we got to move fast, you know, so I don't want to have to think about diversity or, you know, bring on women or bring on, you know, people of color or bring on anyone else except for my homeboys, my bros, because we know we work really well together and we can move fast.
And yeah,
although there's some truth in that, like research shows that you can probably communicate better and move faster, you often have much lower and worse results, you know. And so one example I was reading about in preparation for our conversation is this company called Hyperloop One. Have you heard of them?
I had not heard of them, okay. No.
So what's interesting about these guys and thinking about this idea of just hiring like your friends, the CEO and co-founder of this company decided that he was going to hire his brother as a general counsel. He was going to hire their PR consultant, was going to be his girlfriend, and pay them 3 times their normal fees. And essentially, it was nepotism all around him. And so when things went to shit, people were like, wait, time out. Like, are you hiring the best people or the most convenient people in these positions? And so the VCs that were involved were not okay with this, and he got in hot water. Not only that, but it became this culture of like, this is my clique, you know? So if you knew him or related to him or you dated him, you're part of Cool's Club. But if you came in after that, you're almost an outsider. And again, if you're talking about building an inclusive culture, you know, especially with people who don't look like you and they're not family or they're not in your social circle, how are these people going to be comfortable enough to be their authentic self at work, and also bring their best work to the table? I think you're really hindering people from being the best contributors they can be in that situation. So, you know, when you're hiring just your friends, you're potentially looking at legal issues. You're potentially looking at lower quality outcome, and also excluding, you know, people as they come in so they don't feel welcome into the organization. So you might think, I'm just trying to do something that's easy and quick, but what you're doing is building a culture that does not necessarily feel inclusive. So big watch out that I saw in Silicon Valley that we were, you know, at Party Dash and Dash Camp, really intentional and trying to avoid.
Yeah, you know, I think this one is tricky because, you know, sometimes in the very beginning of a startup, when you're at the super early stages, sometimes, you know, you have to rely on the network you've got to start filling those roles, because it really is only the people who kind of know you or know of you by reputation who are willing to kind of be on that journey with you from the very beginning. And so I understand why, you know, the same way Amanda and I were really good friends, we started the company together, that I can understand if I were a solo founder, maybe my first employee also would have been a friend, simply because I would have the knowledge of how that person works, but also that person would have enough knowledge of me and sort of my work ethic and what I've accomplished to have faith in me, even when there is no track record for the business. You know, like at this point, Minted has enough of a track record that when we say we're hiring, we can get lots and lots and lots of people to apply. But in the very beginning, when Minted was mostly an idea, getting people to apply wasn't nearly as easy. So, you know, I think this one,
that's a really good point, KJ, because I think there needs to be a distinction of like, where does that become problematic, this only hiring your friend thing? Because in our case, the point, my co-founder is my sister. And it's because not only do we have complementary skills, but like, we know we work together, we know our quirks, you know, what irritates us. So it does make it easier, you know, than like, you know, I've hired people where I'm like, you're getting on my last nerves, and I feel like you're unaware of it. You're getting on my nerves because you don't know me that well. You know, so I think there's some truth there, but there does come a point where, like, if I was only hiring family, when does that become problematic in your eyes?
Yeah, you know, and it's a good question. I think, I don't know if there's like a specific moment or a specific number of employees. I think, to me, once you have the opportunity to start hiring outside of your circle, if you aren't taking that opportunity, or at the very least looking outside of your circle and your immediate network, that's when it's problematic. You know, like, you might not have that luxury for your first hire or your first designer or whomever. Like, in the very beginning, that just might not be a luxury that you have. But by the time you're on your third, fourth, fifth hire, like, you should be able to reach beyond your immediate network. And if you're not even trying to, that to me is when it's problematic.
Yeah, I think that sounds right. And what I would add is, when you have more than one candidate on the table, and like, maybe the outsider is more qualified and probably can do a better job, but you pick the person that is in your clique, I think that gets a little tricky and starts to look like nepotism. And so, or when you see not only the hiring people, but when you see the people you know, like your friends and your family in the organization, start to rise faster. I've seen that happen too, where it's like, well, this person's probably more qualified, but I'm sleeping with that person. So, you know, he or she is going to accelerate faster. I think a lot of that becomes problematic also.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I will jump in with the next mistake that I think I see people make, and this is sort of what we talked about in the beginning. This idea of essentially just sort of thinking culture, it'll just happen, and putting it off, and sort of assuming like, well, I'm a good person and I work hard and I'll attract other good people who work hard and then we'll have a culture of hard working good people, you
Yeah,
know, and thinking that it'll just sort of fall into place organically. And you know, I think that's a mistake, honestly, that I sort of made and that Amanda and I sort of made. We it's not because we didn't try to be intentional about culture, but we weren't intentional about reinforcing culture in the beginning. So we did sit down and think about like, what are our values, and you know, what sort of people do we want to work here? We absolutely sort of outlined that and thought about it and put some words behind it, but then we didn't reinforce it. And so about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago or so, we rewrote our value statement. We simplified it. And then we made the decision that every month at our team meetings, we would reinforce it by essentially giving out like awards to people for living our values. So we have, it's called Civigia. I may have talked about this before, I don't remember. Civigia is a nonsense acronym, but anyway, it's SFVGIA, and that's for be scrappy, be flexible, be vocal, be generous, be involved, be accountable, right? So, six core values. And every month at our team meeting, we have team meetings every week, but at least at once of those every month, we will sit down and say, give out awards. So we just had it today, actually. And I said, you know what? This week, I want to shout out so and so for being scrappy. They pulled this thing together in 2 weeks. At other companies, they would spend months putting something of this magnitude together. She had 2 weeks to do it. She got it done. She's being scrappy, and I want to shout her out. And we do that every month. So it's clear to our employees, like, this isn't just, you know, these aren't just words on a page for us. We pay attention when you live our values and we shout you out when you exhibit those values. So, and the hope is by constantly reinforcing that, that it becomes clear, like, this is an important part of our culture. This is how we work. We've got to be scrappy. We've got to be flexible. And if you aren't those things, I'm not going to be shouting you out, you know, and that means if I'm not shouting you out, that means you're not really fitting in. And if you're not fitting in, your days are numbered, right? So I think like just it's not going to happen just because you want it to happen. You have to be intentional, not just about setting your cultural values, but about reinforcing them.
That is so good. And what a great idea to give out monthly awards. I think we've probably all worked at companies where the mission statements were on the wall and we will walk past it and people just roll their eyes because it's like, okay, like these are all nice words, but do we live up to this? No. You know, and by, you know, being intentional, not only to say it, but to acknowledge and to reward people for living it, I think that is absolutely the idea of like instilling and being intentional about building a culture. What a great idea. What I'll add here is a mistake I've seen is like, again, I guess because I'm coming out of the Silicon Valley bubble, you know, everyone was like gung ho about perks, 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 perks for a long time. It's like, well, do you get free food? You know, like, do you give massages? You know, what about meditation? And it's like, okay, like, that's cool and all. But at the end of the day, I think if people were just to give out those perks, but not give me meaningful work, would I want to stay there long? I don't think so. If I didn't see road for advancement, would I want to say? Probably not. If I felt like I was hurting our environment or hurting our world, I think that would be problematic. So I think some of these companies sometimes they like push the perks too much and they're not focusing on like the work at hand. And I think how you avoid the mistake is you always lead with the meaningful work the person is going to do, the amazing people they're going to work with, who is their manager, are they going to nurture and develop them? If you're just focused on like, oh, we have like, I've seen a lot of companies switch to this, you have unlimited vacation model, which actually doesn't work. Studies show that when you have unlimited vacation, you actually take less vacation.
Right.
But, you know, so many of these companies are leading with this, where that's not what builds a culture. Like, culture is like how you get stuff done, the social norms. And perks is not a social, I mean, in my opinion, it shouldn't be the social norms. It's really going back to, like, again, meaningful work. How is this company making a difference in our community, in our world, in this particular sector? And I think once you provide purpose to people's work, that's how you start to build a culture that permeates throughout the entire organization.
Yeah, I completely agree. You know, we aren't in a position to just be giving out perks like that. So I can't. So I can't fully relate, but for sure, that is something I have seen companies do, is try to equate their perks to their culture. And it's like, no, it doesn't. It doesn't work like that. Right. So I agree.
Right. And, you know, another part of that is, like, that's fair. Like, we can't pay the top dollar to come work at Dash Camp and Party Dash. But what we say is, with Dash Camp, we are absolutely, you know, like, changing lives, drastically improving lives, you know, like, and everyone knows it. There's no doubt about it. The, you know, working parents who are just overwhelmed and stressed out and have, you know, are just like, I don't know what to do, to give them, like, peace of mind and to essentially, like, give their kids some joy. Like, come on, you know, and we're working mostly with corporations at the point, and the corporations to know that they're creating a more family inclusive culture. Like, we're solving so many problems. It's not just an event, and it's, you know, we're not going to pay you the big bucks, and we don't have chefs. But you are going to be improving people's lives, like, you know, and so going back to, like, what is your why? What is your mission? How is your meaning, you know, improving people's lives? That, and reinforcing, I love your point about reinforcing it, right? Like, this is something we talk about in our team meetings pretty regularly, you know, it's like how we're improving lives. So for us, we don't give out awards, but we read out love notes. So we get emails from our customers all the time about how, like, my kid has, you know, Down syndrome and isn't, and has asthma, and he isn't allowed to leave the house, you know, so it's only social interactions at Dash Camp. Thank you so much, because this is his biggest source of joy. When you read a story like that to the team, you know, during a team meeting, it's like, who cares about, you know, a yoga room when you know that, like, you've changed this kid's life? So that's really important in regards to, like, building a culture that is, like, lasting.
Yeah, completely agree. Well, I will give one more here that I, a mistake that I think I've seen a number of startups make, and that is growing too quickly and hiring too fast, and essentially kind of treating hiring like it's its own form of success. Like, oh, I grew from 4 people to 10 people overnight, and so that in and of itself makes me successful. You know, I just think there's a real danger in growing too fast, because your culture sometimes can't keep up, right? Like, if you've got a great culture with 4 people, but then within 2 months, 6 more people join, you know, those 4 people, as much original 4 people, as much as they are trying to be the culture bearers, trying to be your brand ambassadors, they're all of a sudden outnumbered. And so it's almost like your culture doesn't have a chance to truly permeate the new people coming onto the team. And then they start to dictate what that culture is. So, you know, if you're a rapidly growing startup, this is something that's really difficult and has played out, I think, for a lot of different companies where, you know, they are somewhat overnight going from 10 to 20 to 50 to 100 and beyond. So, you know, and it makes sense when you've got a big company, but I think there are people who they latch on to the idea of wanting to hire and bring on more employees quickly without giving thought to what that's going to do to their culture. And that's where it gets dangerous.
I think that's absolutely right. I know that we were guilty of doing that. Like, Dash Camp over the summer grew faster than anyone could have imagined. And we were forced to bring on a lot more people to help us keep up with the demand. And so we saw some of that happen. It was like, you know, some voices are louder than others. And so trying to, you know, maintain the culture where it's like, hey, it's fun, we're inclusive, you know, we joke and like each other, but we work really effing hard, you know, because mm-hmm. We have a clear mission, and at the end of the day, we're customer first, you know, that was really hard to like maintain that culture. And so, you know, we got to pull back for the fall, but we're already starting to think about the summertime. We have a couple of big client projects coming up, and this time around, we want to be a lot more intentional, like with our onboarding process, with our team weekly meetings. That I might just go ahead and steal this award thing from you. I like that. But it's absolutely true. Like, we were victims of that. And so we want, this time around, we feel like we've learned, and we're going to try to set ourselves up for success. So anyone coming on understands upfront what is the culture and try to maintain that as we continue to grow.
Yeah. And I think what you just said is really important. This idea that I can fail at something culture-wise or mess up at something culture-wise and fix it. Because Amanda and I had to do the same thing when we realized we're not doing a good enough job of reinforcing this culture. And it's, you know, we've made some bad hires and from not doing that. Like, you know, I don't think anyone gets culture 100% right out the gate. You're going to make mistakes. The question is, are you going to do what it takes to, first of all, acknowledge those mistakes, and not just acknowledge them privately, like to yourself, like, oh, shoot, I did this wrong, but to also acknowledge it to your team, you know, and say, look, this is where we've messed up here. This is how we're going to fix it, and then fix it, you know? So I think like that is super important. Just this idea that no one is going to be perfect at culture. It is going to be something that you're going to have to be constantly working at. And when you do mess up, because it will happen, like being willing to do the work to get it back on track, I think is so important.
100% agree. The last one I will add here in regards to cultural mistakes I've seen startups make. And again, hey guys, I'm human, first time founder. One a mistake I've made is this idea of hiring someone who I thought was brilliant, but an asshole. So, you know,
we have all made that mistake.
So there's, you know, a 2x2 matrix. Going back to my consulting days, love some 2x2 matrix. And so let's say on the X axis, there's competency, right? There's people who are not competent, and there's people who are competent. And then on the Y axis, there are people who you like working with, don't like working with. And then there's people that you do like working with. Okay. Imagine that top right-hand quadrant is someone you like working with, and they're also highly competent. That's really where you want to be. That's your sweet spot. But you know what? Those people cost a lot of money to hire. They're cool. They're smart. You want to be around them. They're leaders. Like, they got it all. Top right quadrant. Now, when your early days, like you said, it's just an idea essentially, and you're getting something off the ground, sometimes it feels like, you know, like you can find someone who's like brilliant. They get all the right answers to your questions. You know, and you're like, man, this person, they really get what we're trying to build. But they answer a couple questions that make you go, maybe that was just a one-off. You know, like, oh, they said, oh, my old boss, he was a jerk, but, you know, I was able to still pull off this multi-million-dollar project, and look at my success. Look, guys, at the end of the day, that one asshole can completely tank your culture, tank your culture and your sanity, to be honest with you. And the best way to avoid that asshole is to essentially trust your intuition. It's one of those things where you're like, I like that person. This did give me pause, but they're so great. Let's take a chance. Do not take the chance, because they will almost always inevitably work out to not work out, is what I found to be true. You know, and there's some things you can screen for, like if they're in an interview and the answers feel very self-serving or self-centered, or they're trash-talking their past employers. those are some telltale signs, right? Because if it's all about mm-hmm. them, it's like, what did other people on your team do? Because, you know, I'm guessing that you didn't do that, like, $6 million project by yourself, you know? Or, like, wait, if everyone else is a problem, you know, in your last three employers, are you sure it wasn't you? You know? And so when you're thinking about the culture, especially early on, every single person has the ability to shift the culture, whether good or bad. And so it's critical to, like, avoid assholes. If one happens to slip through the cracks, you have a conversation, you try to get them to adjust. And if adjustment doesn't seem like it's coming because this is just who they are, they're an asshole, it is so much better to cut them sooner rather than later instead of poisoning the entire well.
Yeah, I agree. And also what I'll just say here is, one, I'll say a couple things. One, it's my experience that actually the people who are assholes or aren't a great fit, it doesn't always actually come out in the interview, because some people are just really good at interviewing.
Yeah, true.
And so during the interview, they are, you know, perfectly nice. They give great answers. Their references come back great, so on and so forth. It isn't until you've got them in your company culture that these sort of red flags start to show. So for sure, if you can spot these red flags during the interview process and the reference process, because sometimes that's where it'll come up, absolutely make the move then. But sometimes it doesn't manifest in that process. Sometimes it really does take until the person is on the job. And in that case, I think to your point around trusting your gut, if your gut says, ooh, I don't like how this person handled this, I don't like how this person said this, I don't like that this is coming up to me at this stage, it doesn't feel like it should, trust your gut, make a note of it, tell them, like, listen, this is the cultural norm that you're pressing up against when you do something like mm-hmm. this. You know, give them the feedback, give them the chance to change, but when they don't, because a lot of times they won't, let them go early, not late, mm-hmm. right? Don't wait. And that's the first thing I'll say. And the second thing I'll say is, you know, I think nobody wants to work with an asshole, someone who is legitimately just like rude or mean or a jerk, or, you know, who scapegoats people or who throws people under the bus. Like, nobody wants to work with that guy. But in my experience, when I think about the people who were really toxic for our culture, only one of them was like actually truly someone I'd be like, no, that person's just an asshole. The other people I think about, there are two other people that come to mind. One was not an asshole, but just overly negative. Mm-hmm. Like, so they weren't necessarily so mean to everybody, but everything was so negative. Like, everything was a complaint. Everything was a like, we could have done it this way, you know, like, and that I wouldn't necessarily call that person an asshole, but it's not helpful. Yeah. Being constantly negative, that's not helpful. And that's going to bring down our culture. And then the other person I think about who wasn't a cultural fit had a similar sort of thing where they were negative, but they were just so, like, one of the reasons one of our cultural norms is be involved is because Amanda and I think the company culture is better when everyone is willing to chip in, participate, you know, with whatever the thing is, whether it's inside of your immediate department or not. And this person was always sort of pulling back, like getting them to participate in anything was like pulling teeth, you know? And so that was another thing. They weren't an asshole, but getting them to participate and be involved was just like so much work that, again, it just sort of brought down the group vibe and the culture, because then it made other people feel like, well, if she doesn't need to be involved, I don't need to be involved, you know, like, she's not gonna do it, I'm not gonna do it. So I just think, yeah, the asshole thing, obviously nobody wants, but you have to spot, it's not just about being an asshole, it's like, is this person actively contributing in a positive way to my team's culture? And if not, I'm going to call it out. I'm going to give them the feedback and give them a chance to change. And if they can't change, I'm going to let them go sooner rather than later, you know?
100% agree. And, you know, the crazy thing is, like, if you ask most founders what keeps them up at night, it's often the people stuff, right? Like, for me, when I'm most stressed, is because there's someone on my team that is not a good fit. I'm beating myself for bringing them in, because ultimately I'm the one who like has to green light them, even if they go through 3-4 rounds of interviews. And when I realize that them not being a good fit is not because of the quality of work, because again, like when it comes to the quality of work, like you sometimes don't know that either. Because to your point, they could be talking a good game, and then it's like, wait a second, this is not up to par. And it's hard to know that, you know, if like their references checked out and so on and so on. But if it's like a, like this person is like a Debbie Downer, or like I've had someone on my team who, you know, maybe had some mental health issues because, you know, their emotions were up and down, roller coaster, or someone who's a contrarian, so everything is an argument. Like, that is so taxing and so wearing. And I can't, it's not I can't, I hate using the word can't, but I feel like it's harder for me to be a good leader when like someone's fighting you tooth and nail on every single thing. And so, you know, one thing I've learned is like, I hate to say it, but when you identify like this is a problem and it's not going to change and you try to work on it, it's just so much better to cut them off sooner rather than later. Can't emphasize that enough.
Absolutely. Completely agree.
Well, we went through quite a few major cultural mistakes that we've clearly made a few ourselves or noticed along our journey of being entrepreneurs. And we hope that you, our friends and listeners, have learned a thing or two and have a couple of watch outs as you're building your companies.
All right, guys, that's it for this week. And if you're loving the show, stop right now and subscribe and give us a 5-star rating and tell a friend.
If you have a topic that you'd love for us to dive into, or if you're interested in a sponsorship opportunity, simply send us an email at winddownbuildup@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.